In this world of smartphones and iPhones, scanning codes and downloading apps, I am woefully behind. I certainly am not an IT guy. My native friend in Kenya was on a computer in an internet cafe before I was even online. So I can relate to this amusing intro by Max Licato. The story I'm about to tell qualifies me for admission into a diminishing population. Young people will quite possibly discount what I say to you as hyperbole. No one, they will reason, has been around that long. No one alive, they will surmise, still remembers those days. No one, they will tell their torn jeans wearing, tattoo covered friends is still alive who recalls the day when email entered the world. But as God is my witness, I'm alive. I was there and I remember. It was the last decade of the 20th century. It was just getting underway and Clinton still had some dark hair. Cars had cassette players. And I embraced the misconception that email was a passing fancy. It'd go the way of slinkies and slip and slides. I misjudged that one too. Who in their right mind, I reasoned with my friends, would exchange handwritten letters for electronic mail? What I didn't confess to them and are admitting publicly for the first time is that I simply was overwhelmed by the world of computers. It intimidated me. It was New York City, and I was a country hick. It was Beethoven's Fifth, and I was still clunking playing chopsticks. It was the Pacific Ocean, and I was a minnow, but still I got thrown in. I went to sleep one night in a world of thicky notes, sticky notes. I awoke the next morning in a paperless society that the avant-garde thinkers in our church staff had been dreaming of for months. Just think, they would say to me, move the cursor, click the mouse, and the message is sent. My computer illiteracy was so severe that I thought a cursor was someone who used foul language, and that a modem was something you flushed, and a mouse was a rodent you trapped. As far as I knew, logging on was the job of a lumberjack. And a monitor? Well, we had one guy named Norman in our college dormitory. How was I know that interface was a computer term? I thought it was basketball trash talk to be used after a slam dunk. Interface, baby. Forgive me for lagging behind, or perhaps I should say logging behind, but I was intimidated. I was about as plugged in as a toaster in an Amish kitchen. I didn't know where to start, how to act, what questions to ask. I guess you would say I was overwhelmed. You know that word. You know that feeling. You know that paralyzing, deer-in-the-headlights fear that surfaces when information is too much to learn. The change is too great to make. The decisions are too many to manage. The grief is too deep to survive. The mountain's too tall to climb, and the crowd is too numerous to feed. At least that's what the disciples told Jesus. John chapter 6, beginning at verse 1, after these things, Jesus went over to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, also called the Sea of Tiberias, and a huge crowd of people were following him, because they had been seeing the signs, the significant things he was doing with the sick. So Jesus went up on the mountain and was sitting there with his disciples. Now the Passover, the festival of the Jewish people, was coming up. John does us a favor by mentioning the proximity of the Passover. So he gives us our calendar bearings. Passover was a springtime celebration. The winter dull of January and February was giving way to the warm breezes, the wildflowers of March and April. This is the first of three Passovers mentioned in John's Gospel. Jesus was just two springtimes away from his final Passover in the upper room. For the Jews, Passover was a season of celebration, a season of possibilities, a happy recollection of the exodus from Egyptian bondage that whet the appetite for a repeat performance. Would deliverance come in the hands of a Nazarene miracle worker? Might he be their Moses, lead them into the promised land? They hoped so. They had seen the signs he had performed. They knew about the healings and the teachings, and so they followed him around the Sea of Galilee. At a certain point, Jesus realized that the multitude had nothing to eat. They had no more food in their sacks, or they had no food trucks or stores in which to shop. These 15,000 plus people, 5,000 men plus women and children, were hungry. Verse 5, where can we buy enough bread to feed all these people? Jesus was asking this to test Philip, because Jesus already knew what he himself was going to do. Philip responded, several thousand dollars worth of food would not be enough to give even a tiny bite to all of these people. Then one of Jesus' other disciples, Andrew, the brother of Simon Peter, said to him, there's a boy here with five loaves of barley bread and two fish. Oh, but what are these things when there are all these people? Philip, a practical sort, looked out over the sea of faces. He heard the murmurs. He imagined the grumbling stomachs and replied without hesitation, we ain't got what it takes to face this challenge. Our purse hasn't got the coins. Our budget hadn't got the moolah. Our capacity hasn't gotten the ability. There are just too many mouths and not enough dollars. Note the three repeated times the phrase, all these people. Jesus questions, where can we buy enough bread to feed all these people? Philip's response, several thousand dollars worth of bread wouldn't be enough to give even a tiny bite to all these people. Andrew's idea, to start with the boys' lunch, but then what are these things, these loaves and fishes, when there are all these people? Jesus acknowledged all these people. Philip saw no help for all these people. Andrew had an idea, but the suggestion wilted in the face of all these people. What's your version of all these people? It might be something as pedestrian as all these diapers, or all this homework, or all these long days. Or it might be as disruptive as all this dialysis, all this depression, all these bills. Whatever it is, the demand outstrips the supply, and you are left feeling as hopeless as Philip and as meager as Andrew. We'd like to think the followers would have responded with a little more faith. After all, they'd seen Jesus turn water into wine. They knew about the lame man who had walked. We'd like to see more spunk, more grit, more, "We can't, but you can, Jesus." But they and the others stood silent, no spark. They counted the hungry people, the money in their bag, and the amount of bread and fish. They did not, however, count on Christ, and he was standing right there. He could not have been nearer. They could see, hear, and touch him. Yet the idea of soliciting his help did not dawn upon them. Warren Wiersbe, in his study Bible, comments, "In this passage, there are four possible solutions to the need. First, the disciples suggested that Jesus send the people away." That's found in Mark 6:35. The second solution came from Philip in response to our Lord's test question, "Raise enough money to buy food for the people." The third solution came from Andrew, but he was not quite how sure the problem would be solved. But he did find a young boy who had a small lunch of 2 fish and 5 barley cakes. The fourth solution came from our Lord, and of course it was the right one, the true one. So Jesus went right to work. Verse 10. Jesus said, "Please get the people seated." There was a lot of grass there. The people sat down. They numbered about 5,000. So Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated, as much fish as they were wanting to. J. Vernon McGee, in his Through the Bible commentary, writes, "Jesus told them to make the men sit down, and they sat down. Mark emphasizes the fact that they were in various companies, that is, each of the groups of people which had come from a certain area, they sat down together. They may have been distinguished by robes of a certain color from their own area. Everything the Lord had done was done correctly, decently, in order. And each little group of color was on the background of green grass. I'm of the opinion that if you could have been on the hill on the opposite side from where the people were sitting, you would have seen something like would have been as beautiful as a patchwork quilt. It would have been very orderly because our Lord was doing it. So when the people were satisfied, Jesus said to his disciples, "Please gather up the leftovers so that nothing will be lost." Well, they gathered 12 whole baskets of leftovers from the overflow to those who had eaten the 5 barley loaves. Max Lucado observes, "I envision those people sprawled out on the green grass, so satisfied that they needed a nap, and those who didn't sleep picked their teeth. Hungry bellies had become happy bellies. There were so much food that there were 12 baskets left over, one for each of the doubting apostles. The impossible challenge of feeding all these people became an unforgettable miracle to see them fed. The Galilean Gazette carried the headline, "Banquet for Thousands," and this lead sentence, "Christ did what no one imagined, just as he did at the wedding." Isn't that the lead sentence of the gospel message? What we cannot do, Christ can do. The problems we face are opportunities for Christ to prove this point. And if you see your troubles as nothing more than isolated hassles and hurts, you'll grow bitter and angry. But if you see your troubles as opportunities to trust God and His ability to multiply what you give Him, then even the smallest incidents take on significance. Do you face 15,000 problems? Before you count your money and your bread and or fish, before you count yourself out, turn and look at the one who's standing next to you. Count first on Christ. He can help you do the impossible. You simply need to give Him what you have and watch Him work. Verse 11, Jesus took the loaves. He didn't have to use them. He could have turned the bushes into fruit trees. He could have had the Galilean Sea spew out an abundance of fish. He could have made manna fall for the Israelites. He could have done it again. Instead, He chose the simple single basket of the small boy. What's in your basket? All you have is a wimpy prayer? Give it. All you have is a meager skill? Use it. All you have is an apology? Give it. All you have is strength for one step? Take it. It's not for you and not for me to tell Jesus our gift is too small. God can use a small thing and make it a very big thing. He used the whimper of baby Moses to move the heart of Pharaoh's daughter. He used the faulty memory of an ex-con to free Joseph from the prison and send him to the palace. He used David's sling and a stone to overthrow the mighty Goliath. He used three nails and a crude cross to redeem humanity. If God can turn a basket into a buffet with food to spare, don't you think you can do something with the five loaves and two fishes of faith that you have? Biddy Chambers did. Had she given up, no one would have criticized her. Had she walked away, no one would have thought less of her. Her God-given assignment was to partner with her husband in teaching the Bible. They met in 1908, and in 1910 they were married, living in London, busy about their dream of starting a Bible college. They purchased a large home and made the rooms available for students and for missionaries on furlough. Biddy's training was in stenography. She took careful notes of her husband's lectures and turned them into correspondence courses. At the outbreak of World War I, he felt a call to minister to soldiers stationed in Egypt. So he and Biddy and their 2.5-year-old daughter moved to the Middle East, where he took a position as a chaplain. Their ministry continued. He taught, she transcribed. He lectured, She captured his messages. It was a perfect partnership. But then came the setback. Her husband's complications from appendicitis rendered Biddy a widow. Her husband died at the age of 43. She buried him in Egypt and returned to London to face the question, how could she partner with her husband if her husband was gone? All her dreams of teaching ministry would need to be abandoned, right? No. Biddy chose to give God her loaves and fishes. She set about the work of turning her husband's notes into pamphlets, mailing them to friends and acquaintances. Eventually, they were compiled into a book, My Utmost for His Highest. It was published in 1927, and no one would have predicted the impact this volume would have upon its readers. Its early devotees were Billy Graham, Bill Bright, Henrietta Mears, Bill Wilson, and Bob Smith, the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, used to begin their meetings with readings from its pages. George W. Bush turned to it for inspiration. It has sold more than 13 million copies, and it's been translated into more than 35 languages. The work of Oswald Chambers surely exceeded his fondest hopes, but it was the sincere faith of his wife, Biddy, that made the difference. She gave what she had to Jesus, and with it, Jesus fed and still feeds the multitudes. Let's follow her example. The next time you feel overwhelmed, remind yourself of the one who is standing next to you. You aren't alone. You aren't without help. What bewilders you doesn't bewilder him. Your uphill is downhill for him. He's not stumped by your problem. And when you present your needs to him, he never ever turns to an angel and says, well, it finally happened. I've been handed a code I cannot crack. The demand is too great even for me. You may feel overwhelmed, but you're not. Give him what you have. Offer thanks and watch him go to work. Your list of blessings will be so long that you'll need a new hard drive to store it. Selah.